Accession number 27747, Reel 8.
Graham Pitt, Reel 8.
Well, people gradually left the High Tan, and I was the only accountant officer left. Then judge of my dismay when we got a new commanding officer who was under the impression that he was to sail the ship to Singapore. And I disillusioned him as quickly as I could, partly because I thought that the winding up, the paying off had gone, you know, too far to make it easy to backtrack. And secondly, Singapore was that much further distance from home. So anyway, fortunately he saw the light. Paying off wasn't easy for me because obviously I'd had no experience of doing it before, and by and large, at that period of the war, no one else had either. But after Christmas 45, I handed the ship over to the Ministry of War Transport in the shape of yet a new Serang, oddly enough, who very efficiently deposited a thermometer in the hold to make sure that we weren't also catching fire, which I think was a good thing to do. Mm. I was appointed Pembroke Additional for Disposal, which is a rather odd thing. It sounds odd, but that really meant I was going home, because Pembroke was the depot at Chatham. So that was very nice. Yes. And I got a berth on the Reina del Pacifico, which was quite a large trooper, because it was a mixed bag besides ratings and other ranks. There was a mixed bag of Army, Navy and Air Force. Rather cramped, but who the hell cared, going home. We tried to lay on some entertainment. I remember I did a stint as a quizmaster. I forget what it was all about, but anyway, I did.
Were you getting more news of events at home now? Was the mail still censored?
Oh, censoring of mail. Well, when I was on the lower deck, of course, everything was read by an officer, with the exception of two or three letters which were specially denoted on the envelopes, which were not censored within the ship, but were liable to censorship ashore. So, when you became an officer, you censored your own mail. You just initialled it and the post office put a stamp on, and that was it. Though, of course, once again, you could be inspected ashore. But one of the chores was, as an officer, was censoring mail home. I had to... We probably had about, you know, 10 letters every 2 days of ratings. One tried not to remember what was in them, but it did give a bit of an insight into life in general, problems with wives, you know, that sort of thing. And I know one chap wrote quite a merry letter, and then he put on the flap of the envelope, "Have a drink for the censor." And I thought, I can't let this pass, I put, "Please do." And so sealed it down, and that was it. But when we... Censorship remained, obviously, until VE Day. And then when we sailed from Trincomalee and got south to the point of India, before turning up to Bombay, That was where the censorship area ceased. So I went on the tannel and said, I am the ship's censor officer, now you don't have to be censored, so that's all right. But so that was the end of...
When was that?
That would have been about June 45. Then, of course, when the war ended, censorship over the whole area must have stopped, but I had no personal experience of what was going on in Trinco. The mail used to come through quite well. My parents made a balls of that, because when I went out east, mother wrote to me on ordinary notepaper, and the postmistress at Chigwell said, you know, ships are going out all the time, so, you know, I was waiting it out for a month before I heard anything, you see. But after that, I said, for God's sake, use an air letter card. And after that, I was hearing within 3 or 4 days, which was a bit of a worrying time because my father's health was very suspect. But anyway, he got better in the end. Well, now, reverting to the Reina del Pacifico, each officer did a day as duty officer. I remember going round the mess decks at lunchtime, and there was a obvious troublemakers, you know, all receiving, saying, get to take the mickey out of you, mate. He said, this food is dreadful. So I stood over him and I solemnly ate it for about 5 minutes. It didn't seem too bad to me, and he had nothing left to say because he'd only got about half the meal left. So there we were. We got into the Mediterranean, and there it can be quite rough in the Mediterranean, actually. And it was rough when
which month was this?
That would be February 45, 46, I tell a lie. 46, and the ship rolled something dreadful, and the army disappeared, and most of the RAF did, but not all of them. And of course, the Navy went around business as usual.
How many were you carrying back, approximately?
Oh, I've no idea, no idea at all. Thousands. No, I'm sorry, I can't give a sensible estimate. We went past Jib and turned right to go up the Portuguese coast, and we were fairly near the coast. I remember it was so brilliantly green that we hadn't seen anything like it for 2 years. And the whole of the passengers rushed to the rail of the Reina del Pacifico. She must have displaced 20,000 tons. She was a big liner, and the bloody thing was leaning. So, you know, we said, And we put in at Liverpool, and I'm afraid class distinction ruled, and the officers got off first. And I remember getting a taxi to Liverpool station. But that was a funny thing. There were a couple of ENSA girls on board the Reina del Pacifico, who were reasonably pretty, you know, and everybody sort of said, birds. But, of course, they were commanders and above, you see. But as I drove off in the taxi, there were these two girls queuing for another taxi, and they just looked like everybody else in the queue. Incredible, really. Mm. Anyway, we got a nice train home, actually. I've always remembered that because the carriage was a new one. And, you know, with nice woodwork, I thought, you know, things are very good at home, but of course they weren't. Anyway, we got home and the dog went mad. I almost went round in circles. The next day, I thought, I've got to think about my future career in the Navy. So I went up to Queen Anne's Mansions, which was the drafting authority for the accountant officers, and saw a couple of shore-based types. I think it might have been Lieutenant Commander. Anyway, he opened the page, and there was my glittering career. I think I was rated A-, which can't have been too bad. And I said, you know, what about my next appointment, you know? He said, well, I'm afraid it's the Mediterranean. I said, God. I said, haven't you got a nice cruiser in the home fleet? Oh, you want to go to sea again? Oh, yes, no problem. So he said, how about number 2 in the Cleopatra? So I said, yes, very nice. So that was all right, so I fixed my appointment. Then I went round to the Foreign Office Research Department near the House of Commons and saw the girl I'd been writing to for 2 years, who was leaning up against a filing cabinet when I came in, because I think she probably had palpitations as I had. But anyway, I progressed my suit and...
It must have been an exciting moment for you. We hadn't seen each other for 2 years.
Yeah, 2 years and 3 months, actually. You can ask her about it later on when we're having lunch. But anyway, there we were. So, we had our leave.
Could I just interrupt there, Graham? Just take you back to when you were arriving in Liverpool. And you were still the... No,
we had to do a bit of sort of keeping of order and, you know, entertaining the troops, but we weren't responsible for anything connected with the running of the ship.
Right, I see. Do you know, did you get a bonus when you were travelling home, yes, no. Or when you disembarked?
No. Why do you think we should?
Thought you might have.
Oh, you mean cost of living ashore, that sort of thing.
Well, just coming back from a war, I suppose. Mm. No, there wasn't anything. You just sort of...
No.
There's your last week.
They did have a revision of pay round about then, but I forget the details, but what it did do was to give quite a very good marriage allowance. So that was an incentive to get married before I left the Andrew, which we did, in fact. Well, I joined the Cleopatra at Portsmouth as the second supply officer, which meant that I looked after pay and naval stores, very much what I had been doing in the High Tan, but in a rather more genteel atmosphere. She had just returned from the Far East. The stores were in an absolute mess. I think she had been torpedoed or something. Quite a lot of stuff had disappeared. But so the stores petty officer Hickey and I got down to it, and we got the consumable stores right. But I'd only started on the permanent stores by the time I was demobbed. And even so, we were ahead of the other ships in the fleet. It was a funny sort of period, really, because the Navy was sort of getting back slowly to a peacetime routine. The RNVR people were gradually being replaced by RN, because ships were paying off, so there were more RN people becoming available. There's no point in having small ships in a peacetime Navy. You just tie them up and wait for the next war, you know. And, of course, some of them were ex-prisoners of war. Our captain, well, he wasn't... Robert Shaw was captain when I joined, but Captain Gordon took over from him, and he'd been captain of the Exeter, which was sunk in the Sunder Strait, about March 42. He had had a very bad time. Our dear friends, the Japanese, used to beat him up regularly, you know. Very Christian. Well, they're not Christian, are they? But I don't feel strong. I will never buy now anything Japanese unless I have to. Then there was Lieutenant Fell. The officer's bathroom in the Cleopatra was in the stern, and there was one bath one side and one bath on the other. And occasionally one turned the tap on and all that came out was superheated steam, so you had to rush and bellow into the engine room, you know, get it right, mate. But I remember I was in one bath and Fell was in the other, and he told me they'd dug their own grave. He'd been a prisoner of the Japanese in Java, and they'd been told that they were digging air raid shelters, but in fact they were digging their own graves. But the atom bomb, you see, stopped all that. Then, of course, there were imbalances in the sort of types of rating born. We needed some sort of extra hands, so we got 20 assistant stewards who didn't do any stewarding but rushed around as messengers and things like that. The disadvantage was that the captain was keen on spit and polish, which I am not a man to spit and polish, and I did not like this at all. I remember one other officer saying, "Oh, you're in the Cleopatra?" I said, "Yes." He said, "Oh, they're dining, picked up boat cloaks and swords there." Oh. But he was a good bloke, old Cappy Gordon. You know, I have an affection for him, and he was kind to me, and I was kind to him too. I think actually there was some sort of letter that used to be sent to ships saying, you know, vis-a-vis ex-prisoners of war, be kind to them, because they're liable to be a bit neurotic or something, but there we are. But I remember rounds was always a business every Sunday morning when the captain inspected the ship from top to bottom. And I remember one ghastly occasion when he inspected my mess deck, and I thought I got everything right. He said, "Well, Pitt, the place is superficially clean." I said, "Thank you, sir," or something. Then just as he went up the ladder, he had a view of a trunk, ventilation trunking, which was absolutely filthy. So, oh dear, oh dear. I was also the ship's cipher officer, which terrified me, because anything I have said hitherto about ciphering has been in more or less in the public domain. You could have learnt it all if you'd gone to a course at Maddingley. But things have moved on while I've been abroad, and I needed tuition. The paymaster commander told me that, you know, I was fussing unnecessarily because the cipher in peacetime was a great event. I thought to myself, all the more reason to be able to translate it, you know. But anyway, I did a course at Haslemere, where the Royal Naval Signal School was, to get myself up to date. I got leave to get married, which we did on the 18th of May, 1946.
Where was that?
Oh, Shrewsbury. When an officer gets married, it's the custom of the service is to hoist some sort of garland to them, to the wireless aerials between the masts or something. But they haven't got round to that in my time. But the next officer who got married, he had it, so that was all right. But I didn't waste any sleep over that. I think really, the ship was like the rest of the Navy. It was getting its breath back with, personnel relaxing after, for a lot of them, 6 years of strain. But of course, being the youngsters who had joined the RN during the war would be rather less. But, you know, they were all unbuttoning, and fair enough too. I remember Captain Gordon saying to me, "We shall never get anywhere to this ship until we sail from Portsmouth and get away from the wives." I think we did a trip in the Irish Sea, and then we went to Portland, and such was the state of the home fleet that it then consisted of two cruisers and four destroyers. And this is, you know, after being one of the biggest fleets in the world in the home waters. So there we were.
How long did you have off to get married?
I think I had a fortnight. I think I could have had a bit more, but I felt that was all I could conscientiously take. As I said, the Navy too was adjusting, because the branches had to be reorganised in order to reflect the changes. I remember our torpedo officer, the torpedo officer, for historical reason, doubtless going back to Nelson, looked after the electrics. And I remember there was a new electrical branch to be formed, you know, around about 47. And Keyworth, our torpedo officer, said he was going to join it. Now, whether they looked after the radar as well, I don't know, but I should have thought that would be, you know, rather up their street. The fighter direction officer, who turned out to be a relative of a friend of ours at college, wasn't replaced. And I don't remember either a radar officer or a fighter direction officer as such, replacing him. So anyway, came the time for my debomb in December.
That was December
46. Yes, I went ashore and drew my civvy suit, which was a bit like cardboard. I was recommended for qualified officer status. I thought I'd probably earned that. Because you needed to have that before you could move up to lieutenant commander. I was very ambitious in those days. But I didn't get it. My record was noted, but it wasn't awarded because it wasn't the custom of the service. You know, Nelson didn't do it that way.
Oh dear.
But
Were you disappointed?
No. My reforming seal continued because I've talked about the division between the naval stores between permanent and consumable, which required different methods of accounting. And that sounds all right, but sometimes, and don't ask me to give examples, it's difficult to tell whether a given item of equipment is consumable or permanent, which of course affects the accounting. One or two Admiralty Fleet orders have come out with C or P against them, indicating that they were going to be consumable or permanent. So I said to Stores Petty Officer Hickey, let us go through the rate book and find out a couple of items, you know, one which is in fact permanent but looks as though it's consumable, and one which is consumable and looks as though it should be permanent, which he was able to do. And then we wrote a ceremonial letter to the captain suggesting that the next rate book of naval store should have C's and P's throughout. Whether that came off, I don't know. But that was it. And then I went home.
What was it like going home after spending, well, was it 4 or 5 years on
ship? 42, 43, 44, 45. Just 5 years, of which, you know, only 3.5 for wartime, really. Because that's one of the problems of being Paymaster, or one of the slowest out. They had a very good system of Asian service groups. Do you know about that?
Sure.
No. Well, they produced a table which was based on A, oddly enough, your age, and B, how long you've been in. They sort of married this up together, and you were then got your age and service group. I can't remember for sure what mine was. It might have been 46, but it was very nice and flexible. Yes, that's right. I'm pretty sure it was 46, because they could work it so that the various branches were demobbed at different rates. I was going out at Agent Service Group 46, which was December 46, but Looney Luth, who was the surgeon dentist in the Cleopatra, who was a moaner and needed his arse kicking, actually, he used to grumble because he was going to be, he was, you know, hanging around waiting to be demobbed too, but he was Agent Service Group 51. And I got fed up with him because, you know, he. But some of the executives, you see, might be several, you know, might be 56 or something like that. But it was a good system, and as far as the Navy was concerned, there was no problem with it. I think there had been mutinies in the forces after the 1418 affair, and there was trouble with the RAF in India, I believe, but I can't be sure of that.
It had been a very formative period of your life.
Oh, yes, yes. I grew up in the Navy, and I think I can't compare it with anybody else, but I suppose 21 to 25 is formative years for any youngster. Mm. But it certainly was for me. I thought you might ask me that, and I thought a bit about it. If one had to go to war, the Navy, I think, was a good service to be in, and I'm pleased to have done it. And if you're historically minded, I'm going to be sentimental now. After the Barents Sea affair, the CNC was kind enough to say that we had behaved in the best traditions of the service. Now, that phrase, best traditions of the service, takes you straight back to World War One, Nelson, Howe, Hawke, Rodney, right back to 1660.
Yes.
And I must say, I find that rather satisfactory.
Yes.
And if you say that's an old song, you'd be right, but it does.
Mm. Yes.
But anyway, after that, I had to settle into City Street. I found it a bit hard, actually, finding what to do at night. But I thought I'd better. I took the bar exam, and then I went to took the exams of the Chartered Institute of Secretaries.
So you were not only and going back to Civvy Street, but you'd entered married life as well at the same time.
Yes.
So it was a big life change.
Yes. And we happened to home. My wife had a very bad break in health. I think really it was the war. I mean, let's face it, she'd been in far more danger than I had with the B1s and the B2s, living in Hampstead in a flat there. She was in the thick of it. And she had her health was poor, very poor to begin with. And we lived with my father and mother-in-law, mother, which was all right for me, but rather less so for Mary, I think.
And that was in
Chigwell.
In Chigwell,
yeah. I got a job at Potter and Moore, where I was spoken for in the best East End tradition. And there I did sort of secretarial work, costing, and believe it or not, production efficiency. But then,
where was it based? Potter and Moore?
Leighton.
Yes.
So I could get there quite handily. The disadvantage of being a pit boss for the whole family was in the Potter and Moore group of companies. W.J. Bush was the parent company, and that was a subsidiary. The technical director at Potter and Moore decided to go to Australia, I think with a bit of stuff, I'm not sure about that, I can't remember now. So they want another technical director, and that was right up my brother's street. He was in Bush, so he came across to Bush, to Potter and Moore, and I had to go over to Bush. And I wasn't really best pleased of being moved around like a bloody chessman.
Mm.
So I started looking around for another job, and Mary saw an advertisement in the Times for the personal assistant to the secretary of the Building Societies Association, who required some appreciation of legal and accountancy jobs. So I tried for that. As it happened, there were 150 applications, but I was shortlisted to 12, and went before the interview board, and it was one of those days where nothing could go wrong. And I got the job, but I mean, had I known how many were in for it, I wouldn't have bothered. But anyway, But anyway, I stayed with the BSA for the rest of my life.
Of course, did you? So it was a momentous interview, really, that.
Yes. Well, the building in my time with the association, which extended from 52 till I retired in 84, building societies were a power in the land, and I ended up as head of the legal and practice department, got the OBE, so I suppose I can't have done too badly, but I had to keep an eye on all the legislation passing through Parliament and liaising with the Land Registry, government departments, the Law Society, Royal Institution, Chartered Surveyors. It was a varied job. But mind you, I took care to have backup, which I chose, and made sure that it was my patronage and some competition to get on my panels. But anyway, there we were, and I stayed there till 84 and retired. But since then, what did I do? I became a regional director for the London and South East Board of the Bradford and Bingley Building Society, which was very respectable in those days. Not quite sure the way they've gone since I retired, but we won't mention that while we're recording on Christ. They were setting up a new community centre around the corner, and Mary was involved in that, and I joined her in that one. They were setting up a new hospice, which you pass at Junction 7, St Clair, and I was a founder trustee for that. Came in quite useful in the early days. But the one very unusual experience was Mary had a friend who was the parliamentary officer for the National Schizophrenia Fellowship. And she wanted a bill on schizophrenia aftercare drafted. So I had to sit down and draft this bill.
Oh, have you? Yes.
And it was introduced in the House of Lords, and of course their lordships made some amendments, which I had to draft. But they were pleased with it by the time it had finished. But when it went to the Commons, of course it was thrown out straight away because they said they had no money. But a rather pity, really, because schizophrenics, there was... this is quite beside the point, but... When the